Good evening. It's Tuesday evening, July 1st. This is Rabbi Feldman's shiur. Tonight's shiur is sponsored by the Barth and Selesky families. It's from at the yard site of Jerry and Aggie's father, Yehuda Aryeh Ben Chaim.
Good evening. Last week we spoke about one aspect of Nisiyas Kapayim, the Brechas Kohanim. And tonight we're going to go back to the topic in a broader sense. Talk about some of the larger themes and see how that topic spoke about last week maybe fits into it. There is a mitzvah in the Torah of Berachas Kohanim. We heard about it in Parshas Nasa, which we read a few weeks ago. And the Torah tells us that the Kol Sivarecho was B'nai Yisrael, that these famous psukim that we're familiar with are supposed to be conveyed to the Jewish people as a bracha. And you find a lot of discussion, a lot of unclarity as to how do you categorize this concept. Is this concept a type of tefillah? Is this some aspect of prayer? Even though generally we don't find tefillah min ha-Torah. Tefillah is normally not an obligation min ha-Torah. Nowadays we have it incorporated into our Shmoneh Esrei, whether it's done in the full sense that we see in Eretz Yisrael every day, whether it's done in a shorter sense that we have in our Siddurim. We have it incorporated as part of our tefillah, but tefillah is a drabanan, usually Shmoneh Esrei is a drabanan. So do we see this as an aspect of tefillah and coming from the Torah? Or do we see this as a type of avoda, a type of the service of Kohanim, and that would be why it's limited to Kohanim? So we find that there are certain ways in which it's connected, certain ways in which there's a hekesh, in which there's a linkage between avoda shakohanim and brachas kohanim. We find other ways in which it doesn't match. So it prompts a discussion in general, how should you categorize brachas kohanim? What does it fit into as far as the structure? So I'd like to look at some of the rules that we find about brachas kohanim and see if it sheds any light at all into how we should understand it. First of all, there's an interesting rule that Birchas Kohanim has to be recited in Hebrew. We say, Kol Sivarechu, this is how you shall bless them. And the Talmud in Masech HaShota is Daf Yomi around now, maybe even be Daf Yomi today. Daf Yomi, it was one day ago, okay, it's Daf Yomi right about now, where we're taught that Kol means like this, Kol Sivarechu, it's got to be exactly like this. It's got to be B'lashon HaKodesh. It's an interesting word I remember seeing once many years ago, and a Sefer picked up, I think it was called Minchas Machlas, had a cute idea that we know in the beginning of Parshas Vayishlach. So the message is sent from Yaakov to Esav, and he says, Kol Somrum Adoni LeEsav, this is what you shall say to Esav. So why does it have the language Ko, like this? So that was a very famous Rashi over there, that part of the message that Yaakov sends to Esav is in Lavan Garti. I have lived with Lavan, and Rashi says, Garti, Taryag Mitzvah Shamarti, the Garti, the same letters as Taryag. So this day from Erchas Nachvitz suggested that that's why it says Kol Sivarechu. It has to be in Hebrew because the Gematria is not going to work if you do it in any other language. You've got to do it in Hebrew in order for that Vort of Rashi to be able to be perceived. It would have to be played out that way. So in any event, so we find that this din that Berachas Kohanim has got to be recited in Hebrew, and that's unusual because when it comes to Tefillah, even when it comes to Kriyat Shema, which is Bereishit, so we find that we are open to other languages, and we find that we normally don't have a din, certainly not the Eved, of specifically taking place Lashon HaKodesh. Al pi derech hadrush or al pi derech hashkafa, we can understand why it is. The Nassim Gestetner, in his commentary, I think, to Chumash, observes that we have an idea in general. We tell people that Kodesh Baruch Hu should be Amale, Kol Mishalos, Libechol, Tova, that God shall fill all the desires of your heart for good. So what does that mean? Why do we ask for good at the end? That's presumably what we mean. So we recognize that we don't always know what's best for us. That we have this, we could want something, and as the expression says, be careful what you wish for, so you might get it, and it may not turn out so well. It may not be what's best for you. So therefore, we specifically say that Kodesh Baruch Hu should not only give you everything you want, that it should be l'tova, that it should also be for good, that what is best for you and what you want should, to the greatest degree possible, should overlap, should be in the same place. So too, when it comes to Berachas Kohanim, Berachas Kohanim is supposed to represent the ultimate bracha, this epitome of a blessing. So there's no room, there's no wiggle room. There's no room for us to interpret what we want it to mean, how it should be, for us to convert it into a different language. It's very specific, and it has to be done specifically with the Lashon HaKodesh. So in any event, we have this din that is supposed to be the Lashon HaKodesh, and it's not given to other languages. In addition, we also find that there is a rule that a Kohen She'avad Avodah Zarah is not supposed to dochen. He's not supposed to be involved in Brachos Kohanim if he was involved in idolatry. And it even sounds like, even if he stops being involved in idolatry, still not supposed to be involved in the Brachos Kohanim. So that leads a discussion that maybe we should say that the Talmud tells us that the observance of Shabbos is also a type of declaration of faith in God. That we acknowledge that God created the world in 7 days, so we take off one out of every seven. And the Talmud sometimes connects rejecting this principle to rejecting God, a type of idolatry. So in some contexts we find this equation. So there were some who say that therefore Shabbos observance should be the same rule, that we should also insist on that for Berachas Kohanim. And that was the opinion of the Mishnah Berurah, of the Shulchan Aruch Harav, of the first Lubavitcher Rebbe, and a few others. But it's interesting that a lot of the major parts disagreed with that. Among them was Rav Moshe Feinstein. Rav Moshe Feinstein suggested, and his tshuva is a very interesting tshuva, which covers a lot of different themes, is that we don't equate the violation of Shabbos and idolatry in all contexts. It's only true to a certain degree. It's only true with a certain type of intent. And he says if you learn thoroughly the laws of idolatry, which most of us don't, you find that it's not always equal even within idolatry. There's different types of avodah zarah. There's different types of avodah, different types of service, and they don't all have the same halacha. And when it comes to avodah zarah, so we see that it's not even given to tshuva. But even if he repents, he still may attach the status. I know some would debate that. For sure we wouldn't say that when it comes to Shabbos observance. For sure we wouldn't say that becomes a permanent blemish. So therefore, clearly it's not equal. So once it's not equal, so then the whole halacha doesn't really follow. He said in general, nowadays the comparison of one to the other is different because it used to be that a person going to violate Shabbos in public, he's making a certain statement. And nowadays, it's not necessarily the same statement. So he's not sure that the equation necessarily follows. And it makes a fascinating statement, which is not about this at all, but just it may have some other implications. The whole tshuva is fascinating because of how it goes through what the significance of Shemir Shabbos nowadays is and what the significance of violating Shabbos is. But then he says, so therefore, in his mind, the halacha does not dictate that somebody who violates the Shabbos shouldn't be duchening. Now maybe you might think it's a good idea to make a policy that we should tell the Kohanim they can only duchen if they observe Shabbos. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. But the point is that this is a mitzvah at the moment. It's a biblical mitzvah to do the Nesiyas Kapayim, to do the Berachas Kohanim. And we don't have a concept that Chazal uprooted this mitzvah. You know, sometimes we do find that. Chazal said, don't blow shofar on Shabbos, don't take a lulav on Shabbos. They can make certain institutions in order to protect other mitzvahs of Torah. So maybe they would have made such a thing, but we don't find it anywhere. And if we don't find that the Bezdin ever did that, then or now. Which is fascinating because it kind of suggests that in theory there is a Bezdin nowadays that would have the authority to get together and make a declaration to negate a positive mitzvah. So that's that sentence fascinating. But in general it says you don't find that. A similar psak, but for different reasons, was echoed by another of Moshe Soloveitchik. The Rav's father is quoted by the Rav in the Sora Journal, in which he explains that we wouldn't follow one to the other because the idea of Shabbos violation being like avodah zarah, so that's a comparison of severity, it's a conceptual comparison, but it doesn't mean it's the same thing. And he also draws on the fact that that tshuva makes a difference, and it doesn't make a difference for avodah zarah. So what does that show you? So that shows you that it's not anything to do with the severity of the transgression, that it has to do specifically with what idolatry does to the person. Idolatry attaches a certain status to the person, and whatever it is, that creates a problem as far as Berachos Kohanim. So that has its own issue, but it wouldn't follow to Shabbos violations the same way that the Mishnah Berurah took that position as well. There are others who took a similar position as the Chuvas. His name is the Yakov Rav, the author of the Chuvas Chukei Chayim, and he took a position that he thinks there's room for stringency on this issue. He says, if this is a Parshas Korach topic, he says, if God forbid it would lead to machlokas, if it can lead to people fighting about it, then it's not the kind of thing to insist upon. And essentially, in another Chuva, he basically takes a position like Rav Moshe and like the Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, that it's not necessarily a concern to have. Now you find other disqualifications. There's also a disqualification of murder. This is that Kohen Shaharag HaSanyatish, if a Kohen killed somebody, so then he's also disqualified for Berchas Kohenim. And the Shulchan Aruch says even if he does Tshuva, it doesn't make a difference. And the Ramah says he's not so sure that Tshuva doesn't make a difference. And based on that, you will find a big discussion once you see the Tshuva already suggests that it's talking about the transgression of murder. But not everyone agrees that that's the issue. There are some who suggest that if a Kohen killed somebody, even if he didn't do it as murder, perhaps even if he did it to a couple of levels, he could do intentional murder, he could do accidental, you could do justifiable. So each level is different. So what if it was an accident? There are some of the Shuvas written about, say, a Kohen killed somebody in a car accident. Let's say he was negligent. Let's say that's the factor. You find the Tshuva literature about that. And let's say it was justifiable. Or let's say it was compulsory. Let's say, for example, he was in the Russian army. So it wasn't necessarily a war that he had to be fighting, but the government forced him to do it. So he killed somebody basically by owner, so that the Moshe Feinstein has a Tshuva in which he's lenient about. And there's extensive literature about this, about the Israeli army, about other contexts where somebody is acting in self-defense. So there's two different components there. On the one hand, the fact that the act itself may be justifiable. On the other hand, the fact that it may not be your choice. So does that make a difference? So all of this is discussed extensively in the Tshuva literature, and it really raises the question, so what is the problem? Is the problem that this is a transgression that's so severe that it disqualifies somebody from being involved in Berachos Kohanim? Or maybe it's not about the transgression. Maybe it's about the nature of this act is inconsistent with the atmosphere of Berachos Kohanim, just like we find by David HaMelech. We find that David HaMelech was disqualified from building the Beis HaMikdash because of people he had killed, even though he killed justifiably. He killed in war, defending the Jewish people. But nonetheless, God said to him, that's not what I want for the Beis HaMikdash. I want somebody who wasn't involved in this at all. So since Berachos Kohanim, as we see, we have this theme of peace and love going through it, so maybe even if a person justifiably was involved, or by necessity was involved in killing somebody, maybe that may still not allow him to participate in the Berachos Kohanim. That's a debate the post can have. It's also a question, to what extent does this apply to other forms of killing? For example, Rav Wozner and his Shuvah Sevet Alevi and Rav Nachman Gishetner and his Shuvah Laharis Nachman both have discussions about a Kohen who goes around embarrassing people, because the Talmud says that if you embarrass somebody, so that's considered to be like Shvi'ah Chasam, and that's considered to be like killing them. So maybe we should say that if embarrassing is like killing, so therefore a Kohen who embarrasses people should also be disqualified from the Berachos Kohanim. So neither of them thought so. Thought that was a little bit too far to take that comparison. Rav Nachman Gishetner specifically points to the fact that the statement the Gemara has about this, the Gemara in the end of Masechet Brachos, quotes a pasuk from Yeshayo, Yudechem Damer Maleyu, that your hands are filled with blood, and therefore hands like that shouldn't be used as part of the Nesiyas Kapayim, the lifting of the hands, for the Berachos Kohanim. So therefore he suggests that even if you were to say that embarrassing was actually equal to murder, but we're talking about physical murder done with the hands, and therefore it wouldn't follow, it wouldn't go. There are some contemporary Svarim on Berachos Kohanim which actually do take that point a little further and think that maybe such a person should be included, and others weren't so sure. Then they're up. Sorry? That's true. But it's interesting. Right, it's interesting where exactly you draw the line. The Chassam Sofer in his commentary to Chumash has a comment in one place where he writes that Moshe Rabbeinu wasn't qualified to be the Kohen Gadol because he killed the Mitzri. Having that history was enough to disqualify him. It's an interesting idea. So maybe there's necessity and then there's justification that Pinchas is on a whole different level. This is establishing the line of Shalom for the nation. And it's an interesting discussion to figure out exactly where it fits into the discussion. So once we say, sorry. So that's, it's a question like, oh, he goes to the halachic decisors. So there are those who thought one way, and there are those who thought another way. It's, in general, this issue, the attitude you find on the poskim is people aren't going to be too aggressive about it. That if somebody is up there duchening, usually people are not investigated. The rabbi doesn't go through each kohen first to see who he is. So it's usually the kind of issue that we normally assume kohanim are fit, and it's only if they come to ask the question that the question really comes up. But once we debate the question of whether a murder has to be physical or not, we also find poskim talking about what if somebody kills somebody through mystical means, what if somebody uses the holy name and is able to kill somebody, which goes back to the Moshe, because we find some sources in Chazal that that's how Moshe killed the Mitzri. So if you're going to focus so much on the hands, then maybe we should say that if it's not through physical means, maybe that's not going to be a problem. That's or it's not going to affect Brachas Konim, at least I'm not recommending it. So then that also goes to this question of understanding a little bit what this whole disqualification is about. We also find that there is a disqualification which is even harder to examine, maybe just there in theory, that if a Kohen rates the congregation, or the congregation hates him, and if they don't get along with each other, so there's a statement in the Zohar that that's not appropriate for Berachas Kohanim. And the Magen Avraham on the side of the page of the Shulchan Aruch, so he quotes this and he says that that's because why we say in the Bracha that the Ahava, they have to bless with love. If they don't feel love one way or another, they're not feeling the love, so then that's going to be a problem for Berachas Kohanim. And then again, later post-Kohanim, that's also a little bit hard to put into practice day to day, but in theory you find such a concept as well. That's what he writes. The Magen Avraham writes to the Zohar that it seems to go both ways. That if he doesn't like them, or they don't like him. So again, in practice, we've never seen that put into play, but in theory, you find that also. So the topic that we focused on in the broader sense last week, and we'll just mention it quickly now, is that we also find that there is a discussion whether there's a possibility of doing Berachas Kohanim through Shomei Kohanim. Let's say instead of having all the Kohanim get up there, you want to just have one Kohen get up there and bless the Tzibur, and the other Kohanim will listen to him, and it's as if they said it. That's the same mechanism that we find in other areas of halacha. We find that people often hear other people recite Kiddush for them, they read the Megillah for them, they can listen to somebody else, and it's as if they're saying it. So maybe such a mechanism should work by Berachas Kohanim as well. And that was a controversial topic. As we alluded to last week, so Rav Shlomo HaKohen of Vilna, who himself was a Kohen, so he writes that when he visited Trieste, the Sephardi community there was mechabit him with Berachas Kohanim, that they honored him that he should go up and perform the Berachas Kohanim for everybody else. And the Rav Shiva Velazhin, the Tziv, saying he took issue with this in his tshuvas. He took issue with the concept in his tshuvas, and there's a statement in the Yerushalmi on the end of Maseches Rosh Hashanah that the Rif quotes, as the Ran discusses at the end of Rosh Hashanah, is that there are three things which are not susceptible to Shomei Ka'ona, Tzila and Berachas HaMazon, Kriyashma, I think is the third, that's the third or not, but three things which are not given to Berachas Kohanim, apparently because they're, I'm not giving to Shomei Ka'ona, excuse me, because they're apparently of a certain personal nature. And even though what Tefillah and Berachas HaMazon we do find it, it seems that we find either we only find it very much for the Avim, there's no other choice, or it could be that we find it in a different structure. We find, like for example, Berachas HaMazon may not necessarily be Shomei Ka'ona, maybe there's an idea of a group benching as what a Mezumin represents. But in any case, without going into details about that, so there is a statement in Yerushalmi that there are certain types of things that are not meant to be done through Shomei Ka'ona. So then it's if understood that Berachas Kohanim should be grouped with that part of Tzila in its understanding, and therefore it's not really something that should be done through somebody else. And as we mentioned last week, sorry. Right. Correct. Then instead of what we do,
of the congregation who, instead of being a recipient through a group of Kohanim, when you distribute only through one Kohen.
So that's a good question. Yeah, it does have an impact. Let's talk about that now. So this is relates to the point that we spent most of the time on last week, just to say in the Talmud still perform here. So the other Yeshiva of Lazin was the Beis HaLevi, the original of Yeshiva HaLevitic, and the Beis HaLevi also took issue with this from a different perspective. As we mentioned last week, he didn't identify there was a Shalom HaKaran development. He says a certain Chacham who had this idea. And he had mentioned it in explaining a Mishnah in Megillah. Mishnah Megillah says that if somebody gets Nastir, which nowadays is a big honor, but in the time of the Mishnah it wasn't considered to be so distinguished because it's not one of the normal aliyahs. So the Mishnah says that he'd be given some consolation prizes also. But who knows, they ask Kappa, if he gets the Duchen. So people ask, what does that mean he gets the Duchen? It's not a special honor we give one person. Either you're not a Kohen and you're not eligible, or you are a Kohen and you go up anyway. So what do we mean by this person gets it? So basically, because this anonymous Chacham who was of Shlomo Mizolna as saying that it means that it was done through Shemei HaKohen. That the Mishnah is referring to having one Kohen get up there and do it on behalf of everyone else. So the Beis HaLevi took issue with this. The Beis HaLevi said it's not possible that you can't use Shemei HaKohen for Berachas Kohenim, because there is a requirement of Berachas Kohenim that it's got to be done b'kol rom. It's got to be done in a loud voice. So what does he mean by this? And again, this was a thrust of our discussion last week, so some understand that he meant, many understood, that what he meant was that Shemei HaKohen only works for words. It means that if I listen to words, as if I'm saying them. So if a mitzvah only involves words, so then you could use Shemei HaKohen and it's going to be effective. But if there are other details on top of the words, so then how is your listening going to make those details happen? So therefore, since we see another detail of it has to be in a loud voice, that's not going to be effective. And a lot of others argued on this, but we find that you can make Kiddush and people listening don't have to have a cup of wine in their hand. People can listen to Megillah and they don't have to have a cup of Megillah in front of them. This is the way the Chazon Ish explained against the Beis HaLevi, that we don't find that it's a problem to have other details involved. That Shemei HaKohen means that if you hear someone make a bracha, so you fulfill it the same way he does. So you get all the rules. You get the cup of wine, you get the kosher Megillah, and you get the loud voice also. It all works. You hit your ride with him, you get everything that he does. Not just that there was a time, there are many who feel that that should be the view nowadays. There are those who continues to be a machlokas. Certainly there was a time when that was more prevalent. But there are people who feel nowadays that really ideally Kaddish means one person is to recite the Kaddish. And there are people, I believe, Rav Shechter, when he was in Avelos, he wouldn't recite Kaddish if other people were reciting Kaddish. Rabbi Talbot wrote a long piece about this when he was in Avelos. I think it's available. So that's the topic of debate. Certainly the far more prevalent practice is not that way. But there are those who will argue. The much more common practice is that everyone who is saying Kaddish says Kaddish. But there are, this is part of the debate also without getting into this topic on tape, but the question of women reciting Kaddish, so some will argue that whatever practice is being recorded may be referring to a time when only one person is saying Kaddish, maybe it's a different halacha, many people are saying Kaddish. Again, it's a little bit of a tangential topic. But in any event, so when it comes to so the Beis HaLevi said that for the purposes of Berachas Kohanim, it's not going to work because of this rule of Kol Ram, of loud voices. So many people understood that he meant any detail is not going to come along with it. And then they argued based on the other mitzvahs where we find other details indeed do come along. So many of those who received the tradition more directly from the Beis HaLevi, you know, the Soloveitchik family, the Brisker tradition, for example, say for Emek Bracha, Pomeranchik, who was, I believe, a student of the Brisker Rav, and others, have this explanation that they don't think the Beis HaLevi meant that at all. The Beis HaLevi never meant to say that other conditions don't come along. The Beis HaLevi just meant to say that if you have to communicate with somebody, then you can't communicate silently. And the mitzvah of Berachas Kohanim is not just to say it, but it's to communicate. The Kohanim should be communicating to the people. And therefore, how are they going to communicate if they're not saying anything? If they get up there and they whisper, so they're also, that's definitely like speech, but it's still not effectively communicating. So that goes a little bit to what you were asking, that if the mitzvah of Berachas Kohanim apparently has in it that not just that it should be said, but that the people should be hearing it, so then they will be losing out. And that's maybe what the Beis Halevi was getting at, that they're losing out this aspect of having the bracha communicated to them. So there is another issue that we generally assume that Berachas Kohanim is an obligation on the Kohanim. It's a mitzvah saseh, maybe more than a mitzvah, maybe more than one mitzvah saseh on the Kohanim. And the Gemara in Ksuba suggests that it's also a bitul asay, a negation of an asay, if a Kohen skips it, or also if a Yisrael does it. If Yisrael goes up to Duchen, that's also in contradiction to the mitzvah saseh. So does that mean they have no role in the mitzvah at all? So there are some who say that no, there's also a mitzvah on the Yisrael, on the non-Kohanim in the audience, that they should receive the bracha. Mitzvah lehisbarech. That's the opinion of the Charedim. I don't mean that in a cultural sense. It's the opinion of the Sefer Charedim, the Rishon. And he has his view that was quoted by a lot of later Svarim. And even though there are more well-known Rishonim who seem to also have this view, if you look, it seems to be the view of the Ravid as well. The Charedim got the front seat on this one. He was most often quoted as innovating this view, and then after you heard it from him, then you see other Rishonim seem to reflect it also. Again, this Ravid in his commentary to Talmud, and it also sounds like Tosfos in the Masechet Chagiga. It says that the issue, the Gemara talks about a problem that one is not supposed to look at the Kohanim when they're dochening. That's why people cover up their eyes, they look down. Sometimes people turn around, which is really a mistake, because they're supposed to be, that's a sentence, that's as if you're saying you don't want to be involved in the bracha, you're turning your back on the bracha. That's really not, that's really inverting things, both literally and conceptually. It's certainly supposed to be facing the Kohanim, but there is an idea in the Gemara that you're not supposed to be looking directly at them. So why shouldn't you be looking directly at them? So it sounds like from Rashi to Chagiga that there's an issue of the Shechina is on the fingertips and you're not supposed to look at that. The Tosus says a little bit differently. Tosus says that it's a problem of Hesachadash, that maybe you're going to see something that's going to distract you and it's going to break your concentration. So the latest Svarim point out, so who cares? So let's see, so have a Hesachadash, not your Das, it's the mitzvah of the Kohanim. So they point out that you see from that concern that apparently there is a mitzvah on the Yisrael also that they're supposed to receive it, and therefore we have an issue. And in that context, they also discuss, as we mentioned, that we find that there are some ways in which Berachas Kohanim is connected to Avoda, and some ways in which it's not. Like, for example, the idea that Kohen is Tamei Mesh, a Kohen who has come in contact with a dead body, can't be involved with the Avoda, and we don't find that rule when it comes to Berachas Kohanim in certain ways in which it doesn't apply. So we know also when it comes to a Kohen, there's certain physical blemishes that interfere with him working in the Beit, doing the Avoda in the Beit HaMikdash. So when it comes to Berachas Kohanim, so we show him, say, for the most part, it's not a problem, unless maybe it's on the hands, and then people are going to be distracted. So the same idea that people are going to look at that and not listen to the bracha seems to also reflect the idea that there's some obligation on the tzibur as a whole. And on the other hand, there's a ritva, where it doesn't sound that way. The ritva seems to say that there's a mitzvah on the Kohanim to do the Berachas Kohanim, and there isn't a mitzvah on the Yisrael. So some say here the ritva is clearly arguing on the Charedim and all others who have been grouped in that camp. And others say it's not necessarily true that there's a machlokas about it. The Dvar Avram, for one, the Kav Nerav, explains that there is a mitzvah, even according to the ritva probably agrees that there is a mitzvah for the Israel, but it's two different types of mitzvah. That when it comes to a Kohen should try to really fulfill this mitzvah. It means he should try to find an opportunity where he can fulfill it. The Gemara has discussion. He's got to do it then maybe 20 times a day. Maybe he's got to do it every minute he can. So we don't assume like that. He should do it once a day. But at least once a day. He doesn't have a mitzvah to try to seek out more than one opportunity a day. But the Israelites don't have an obligation to go looking for it. But if they're in the congregation and when it's happening, then they have a mitzvah to receive it. And then there is a mitzvah upon them that they should be involved in getting it. There are some who suggest that women should be exempt from this mitzvah, that maybe it's a mitzvah sasei shazlan grama, because it doesn't apply at night, which itself is a little bit of a discussion if that's really true or not, unless women are Torah. But our practice is not to do it at night, so some suggest that would exempt women. It's a little bit of a discussion. This whole idea factors into a very interesting tshuva of the Kajal of a Rav, mentioned in the past. This is a fascinating thinker. As a student of the Avinezer, always has very creative ideas. And he discusses a very unusual situation that we have, that we have an obligation of Berachos Kohanim, as far as we can tell, and this is in the Torah, applies nowadays. And yet, there's such a radical difference between the way it's observed in Israel and the way it's observed outside of Israel. But the way it's observed in Israel, it's done every day of the year. And the way it's done here, we only do it on Yom Tov. Yeah, we do it far fewer times than we do it in Eretz Yisrael. So it's hard to explain why that should be. So the Ramah has this interesting idea that Berachos Kohanim requires a level of simcha, requires that we should have a state of happiness in order to fulfill it. And in Galus, we're not able to muster up that much happiness. We're living in exile, so we can't feel that happy about things. If you live in Eretz Yisrael, you feel that happy all the time. But in America, you don't feel so happy, so it's only on Yom Tov you're going to be able to fully, with that extra bump you get from Yom Tov, then you'll be on the level you feel like you're in Israel every day. In Israel every day, it's like Yom Tov in America. So you'll be happy happy enough on Yom Tov that you should be able to perform the Duchenik. So it's a little bit of an interesting idea. I mean, the Torah doesn't spell that out. So to excuse ourselves with that, it's a little hard to understand. And indeed, there were many who were not rest with it. And they said the Vilna Gaon kept trying to reinstitute Berachos Kohanim every day and was thwarted in his efforts. But there were those who really felt that this approach should be changed. And the Kajal of the Rav has a discussion in which he suggests that it can't be that the Ramah is saying that because of this idea, which again is a later idea, that therefore we did away with the mitzvah of the Torah such a large portion of the year. That it must be that on some level we are fulfilling Berachos Kohanim. It's just that in Eretz Yisrael they do the full-blown Berachos Kohanim. And the way we do it is we have a paragraph that's recited in the Chazaras Hashatz, and that serves as Berachos Kohanim here through Shlichus, that the Kohanim are appointing the Shliach Tzibur that he should perform the Berachos Kohanim on their behalf. So that's very problematic, because normally we have a rule that when it comes to Shlichus, so the person who is performing the agency has to also be part of the mitzvah, has to also be somebody who is equally obligated. So we certainly don't have a concern that everybody who davens shachas for the Amid is going to be a Kohen. Very often the person, you know, by statistics, the vast majority of the time, the person davening for the Amid will not be a Kohen. So how does this work? How can the Yisrael, who's davening for the Tzibur, do Berachos Kohanim on behalf of the Kohanim and fulfill it that way? It's very hard to understand. So there he has a whole analysis, Kedarka B'Kodesh, where he points out that there's an idea that you find in various sources that sometimes this rule doesn't apply if the person who you're using as a shliach is also relevant to the mission. So, for example, there's a rush in the Sefer Kedushin that, let's say, a father wants to marry off his daughter who's younger than Bas Mitzvah, so the father wants to marry her off. So he sends the daughter to, as a shliach, that she should pick up the Ketzef Kedushin. So she's a kid, she's not really valid to be a shliach. But the Rosh says that because it's about her, so now she's able to be an effective shliach. So too here, says the Kajal of a Rav, using that Rosh, again in his typical creative way, he says, now put that together with the Charedim. So you see from the Charedim that the Yisrael is supposed to be the recipient of the bracha, and he's got a mitzvah to do that. So therefore that makes him qualified to be the shliach of the Kohen. The Kohen can use the Yisrael as his shliach because of this idea that he's supposed to receive the bracha. So that's a fascinating idea. So what do you see from all of these things? So we're trying to figure out what exactly Berachos Kohanim is. Is it a tefillah or is it an avodah? So I think the pasuk pshat is that it's really neither. You know, it's a separate mitzvah in the Torah. It's its own idea. And what it seems to be is essentially tevi'achol is a type of show. It's a type of play. And apparently HaKadosh Baruch Hu was saying that I want to bless the Jewish people and I want to use the Kohanim as a kli. I want to use the Kohanim as my vessel in order to convey this bracha. So that could explain really all of these rules. That's why the show, you got to stick to the script. It can't be in other languages. It's got to be the Lashon HaKodesh. And that's why we have certain requirements for what the vessel is going to be. The vessel's got to be somebody who loves the people, somebody who's able to convey Ahava. It's got to be somebody who hasn't deviated from the model of Ahava through an act of killing, maybe even justified. And it's got to be somebody who hasn't disqualified himself as God's vessel through idolatry, and the idea of specifically communicating to the Jewish people, and that's why we have hesitations about Shemei Kahuna. It all represents this theme that essentially here there is this production, more or less, which Kadosh Baruch was saying, this is what I want you to do, and this is how I'm going to convey my love to the Jewish people. And you find that the Yerushalmi says, some of the posts can quote this in the context of the Chol Shabbos discussion or other related discussions. As we mentioned, you know, the question of how much of a big deal to make over people's conduct. So some of the poskim quote that there's a statement in the Yerushalmi that all kinds of different people were involved in Breakfast Cone and people who were guilty of all kinds of things. And that it was inappropriate, says the Yerushalmi, that people should think, people shouldn't have the reaction, what, this guy does X, Y, and Z, and he's going to bless me, even though he does all these crazy things. So says the Torah, no, Bani Avarachim, that whatever this person does is not really the point. The point is that God is really doing the blessings. This is really God's way of creating this message, and therefore we just need that the message should be done in an appropriate way. So it's not necessarily a question of guilt or innocence, as much of a question of what interferes with the message, what is going to get in the way of this transmission of Shalom from God to the Jewish people, and that seems to be what Brechas Kohanim is all about. So I think I don't want to interfere with marriage, so we will skip the Chazara part. I think next week I'm away, 2 weeks this week. Alright, well, we'll be in touch. Okay, so have a wonderful 2 weeks at least. It should be only good things.